everyone, and welcome to Kotaku Split Screen, the show where we tackle video games one excruciatingly specific topic at a time. I am your host, Ash Parrish, and with me are my two co-hosts. Well, I have two co-hosts, but I'm not sure which one to choose. Get it?
Wow, that was beautiful.
This week, we're talking about choices in video games in honor of Legendary Edition having a vice grip on all of us. And by the way, my co-hosts are Nathan and Mike. They're always here.
And Nathan, depending on how you choose to present us.
After you agonized over that choice, it just seemed easy for you.
It's based on who I like more.
Oh my God.
Well, isn't that how we make our choices in video games? It depends on who you like more, right?
True.
No, that's not the part I'm objecting to. I like Nathan better.
I do not like Nathan better. I love you both equally. I hold you both in equal contempt.
There we go. That sounds more accurate. Yeah, I can believe that.
So to start our podcast about choices, I think, Nathan, we're going to talk about a history of choices.
So initially I had the very bad idea to try to do a history of all of choice in video games. And then I realized that games are just a series of interesting choices. So it'd just be a history of every video game. And I was like, well, that's absurd. So instead I settled on the idea of doing a history specifically of the, I would say, equal parts beloved and reviled, like, karma meter system in video games. So the good versus evil meter, or whatever you want to call it, depending on the game it's in. So I'm going to begin this with a question to the two of you. What is the first game that you ever played that had a system like that?
It would have been Star Wars The Old Republic.
Now, do you mean Old Republic or Knights of the Old Republic?
Knights of the Old Republic. I'm sorry. I forgot the MMO distinction. Yeah. So Knights of the Old Republic, I think, is the first one I recall specifically having that choice. No, wait a minute. Wait a minute. Ultima.
Oh, yeah.
Ultima had the whole system, the avatar system with all the different virtues that she could follow.
How old is that game?
It came out in 1985.
Yeah, God. Okay, yeah. So it's really old. Honestly, the first game that I can think of that had like a good meter was, or a good versus evil meter, which is kind of not, you wouldn't think of it like that, but it does have it, is the Oddworld games. You get like karma for saving the Madokans from like the evil factory or whatever, or you cannot, and then you get bad karma. Or if you try to save them and they die in your attempt, like you accumulate bad karma. And at the end, if you save so many, then you get a good ending. And if you don't, you don't. So that's the first game that I can recall that had such a meter that I played.
Yeah, that was one that I didn't even think of. Wow. Done a bad job here already. So Fahey was pretty on the money in that, yeah, as far as I can tell, the game that like mainstreamed the idea or the trend, because as with a lot of early video game trends, like the beginning of this was like five different people having the same basic idea and all doing kind of different versions of it. But the one that really made it take off in the way that I think we understand it now was Ultima, specifically Ultima 4 in 1985. And, despite what the meter would eventually become, being this kind of like, you know, not entirely binary thing, but definitely like, here's one end, here's the other end, and you're on a sliding scale between them. Ultima 4 was like, nah, man, nothing's that simple. Well, and instead, we're going to have eight different virtues, and good luck figuring out how to like maximize all of them. And so there was a really interesting history to that, because The inspiration for this, according to Richard Garriott himself, so, you know, the guy behind the game.
Lord British.
Yeah, Lord British, as he used to go by, which is a funny name. but yeah, he talked about how after Ultima 3 came out, he got all these like letters from people. And like, apparently a lot of them were like complaints about the morality of the game. Specifically that like, and I'm reading this from a US Gamer article that itself is like a book excerpt. But anyway, when they needed gold, they admitted it was easier to bribe or steal than earn money killing monsters and looting crypts. To his horror, many players copped killing off vendors so they could loot their shops with impunity. Just, you know, stuff where it's like, and so that got Richard Garriott thinking, not because like initially he was like, this is absurd. And like, it was a lot of like religious people sending this stuff. So he was like, whatever. But those sort of last bits got him thinking about like, well, if people don't care while they're inhabiting my world, then what does that mean? Like, what is a way to make them care more about their own actions and to play truthfully as opposed to just being like an agent of chaos? And so that's how he came up with the eight virtues. And let's see, I've got to pull
what
up.
What are
my,
the virtues?
There we go.
I knew you were going to ask. And so I'm going to pull open the tab I have that contains them. Which
one is gravy? Let's make our own. Gravy, butteriness.
Yeah, umami. Yeah, keep going.
Umami. Faye. Umami.
That yeah, umami is the one where people are like, what is that again? Like, how do you calculate it?
It's like a combination of the other ones.
Horny should also be a virtue.
Horny.
Oh, man. Horny is the most important virtue of all in this day and age. I just keep... Oh, here we go. Anyway, they are honesty, compassion, valor, justice, sacrifice, honor, spirituality, and humility.
Horny. Oh.
And so, horniness.
Based on my limited ability to understand what Ultima actually is, like, you would make choices in those games and you would, depending on the choices that you make, you would get like a value assigned to one of those virtues?
Yeah, you'd be kind of like building out all of them in various capacities.
Okay.
Yeah.
That sounds cool for a game made in 1985.
Yeah, no, I mean, again, it was remarkably complex for its time and honestly kind of even still in the modern context, mm-hmm. To a degree where it was almost like convoluted in that like there were ways to really game the system. Like apparently you could earn cash quickly by just dying on purpose and then like taking the default amount of cash that Lord British gave you to buy a sword, and then you could just die again and then sell all those swords for cash. Instead of like looting monsters, because like looting killed monsters was considered bad. So you didn't want to do
that. How is that considered bad?
According to one of the virtues, the problem is that they were like, they were sort of like all over the place. And so like, similarly, it was cowardly if you ran from monsters. So that was a bad idea. Yeah. And so it was like kind of a wonky approach to the system, despite having like some cool moments. It was also like, it had some real, like, I was reading about it and there's some moments where it's just like, that feels a little cheap. Like, one of the things in this like book excerpt that Richard Garriott talks about as this big like impasse in the creation of the game is that there was apparently a room in one of the final areas of the game where you like had to, you encountered a bunch of cages in four corners of the room and they all contained what appeared to be children. And then in the heart of the room, between the cages, there's a lever. And if you pulled it, it would lower the cages and release the children. But then they'd attack the player. And so the only way out was to kill some kids, seemingly. But it turns out, in a very, like, again, kind of ridiculous twist, because, like, killing children, right, you'd be like, oh, this is definitely against one of, if not all, of the eight virtues.
Depends on the children.
It does depend on the children, especially in this case, because it turns out they're monsters. There wasn't a way for you to know this until you like attack them, but they are. So don't worry about it. But yeah, apparently like this caused a QA tester to nearly quit. And like, let's see, Robert, who I believe is Richard Garriott's brother, was like, no, yes, we can't sell a game with this in it. Like, even if they're monsters, this is going to make a lot of people upset. They like ended up doing a call with their mom about it.
Oh,
the argument. Yeah.
And fast forward to today, we have, what's that game? Dante's Inferno, where you can kill babies.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, that was the only thing anyone took away from Ultima 4. Was yeah, like, I think games Richard should let you kill babies.
Yeah, Richard Garriott paved the way for baby murder in video games. Now, mm-hmm. I'll always remember him for that, his rat tail, and the spider that attacked me when I attended a barbecue at his house.
Oh, man. Did he did he like up. Stick the spider on you? Had he trained it? He was like, I hate Michael Fahey so much, I'm gonna get him.
I feel like it. I mean, it was a special. There was a special event for a game called Tabula Rasa, which was an MMO.
I remember that game.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that went away quickly because it wasn't good. But they had a press event during a GDC Austin. Mm-hmm. So we went out and there was a tent with tables and barbecue, but there were so many spiders in his backyard and they would jump up on the table and then they'd run. One literally ran at me. Mm. And I fell off the seat, and he references that every once in a while to me when I talk in passing, because the friggin' spider literally came at me, bro. it was like, I'm getting your barbecue, and you're gonna fall on the ground, and I fell on the ground. It was great, but yeah, that was my moral thing. I was like, do I stand my ground with the spider, or do I fall and accept my humility?
Oh, yeah.
One of these days, I guess. We're going to have a podcast that's all Fahey just talking about these old, like, video game stories, encounters that you've had with people. Like, you went to a barbecue at Richard Garriott's house? Like, dude.
There were a lot of people there. House or his, was this his castle or a regular house?
It was his castle. It had hidden passageways in it, and the two-floor circular library that everyone wants was in there, and there was...
Yeah, this
magicians.
Is a real thing.
Yeah, I'm very gullible, right? Because I trust you guys and I love you. So if you tell me this stuff, I'm going to believe it. Oh, and I don't know if you're being bullshitting me right now. Okay,
we're not bullshit about Richard Garriott's castle.
Richard Garriott.
There are some things that are off limits.
Was like a 13-year-old D&D fan who suddenly had millions and millions of dollars. And he did exactly the shit you'd think a 13-year-old D&D fan would do. He bought a castle. Armor, swords, weapons everywhere. Mm. There's a swimming pool that runs through the house in like little hallways. He had an entire automaton room off the main house, which had automatons throughout history. It was a magical friggin' place.
The thing about him too is that while he did eventually, like, I think he sold the castle, he never changed. He's still the same guy. A few years ago, I went to an indie game event in Austin, and there was a game jam where people could, like, you know, they made games, and it was kind of a mini competition. And at the end, Richard Garriott presented the award for the best game, and the award, the trophy, was a crossbow.
No, that's badass.
Yep.
Yeah, no, that's him.
Yep.
He actually for a promo for one of his newer games, he tried to sell some of his blood on eBay.
Oh my God.
Yeah, as a charity thing, there was a vial of his blood inside an object, and they ended up canceling the eBay because he was selling his blood.
Okay, yeah, I guess you're time not supposed
out.
To do that.
Time out. No. For, like, as an aside, like, we need to have a segment one day where it's just you and Faye, where Nathan and Faye just, like, tell me stories about, like, video game people, and I have to guess if they're bullshit.
I don't know if they're real or not. Yeah, that'd be fun. That'd be fun. We should definitely do an episode about just, like, all the weird old men. We're in games.
Oh yes,
that's funny. Anyway, we have
okay. Let's get back to we were doing a segment. I think, who knows? But anyway, so yeah, after Ultima came a lot of other games that included, you know, variations on the idea of karma or of, you know, whatever else you want to call it. Fallout 1 just had like a straight up karma system that was fairly straightforward. Fallout 2 had karma and factions, and then also through performing certain actions, your character could gain statuses like grave robber or the ever popular child killer.
Yay!
Yeah, no. Which also led to things like you could be shopping at a like vendor who would only sell to people with negative karma, but they'd be like, however, you are a child killer, so fuck you actually. Which, you know, when I first heard that, I was like, that's kind of a contradiction. But then I realized that like in like prisons and stuff, which taking a step back, most people in prisons are not bad. Anyway, there's no such thing as a bad person, but that's a topic for another day. But no, I mean, like the thing in prisons is that people are like, anyone who's done bad shit to kids, like at the bottom of the totem pole.
Yeah, they will be murdered.
But yeah, anyway. Yeah, so karma and Fallout also meant that like bounty hunters would attack you and then like killing them would get you even more bad karma. So you could just be in a forever bad loop. The other games from around that time, Baldur's Gate had a reputation system. And so that was less like you're good or you're evil and more like you've done certain things and the world will perceive you certain ways for it. So you could get discounts for having a good reputation, guards would hunt you if you had a low reputation. And most importantly, it determined which party members, which people would stick with you, which you see a lot of echoed forward in like Bioware games and stuff later. Might and Magic had like notorious to saintly. So instead of good or evil, you could be either like people have heard about you because you're kind of a dick to like, you are the most pious individual who's ever lived. And yeah, you could like change that by donating at a temple, or you could do quests. Killing peasants obviously would hit it pretty hard. As would resting or waiting. You would just sort of lose it. You'd lose like a percent of it for every day you rested or waited. One little bit that I really liked about that is that you could also up your reputation by having a bard. And I mean, that makes sense. They like follow you around and do little songs about you. People are like, yeah, I heard about that guy from the bard. But yeah, so let's see. Then kind of during this time and a little bit afterward, like JRPGs also experimented with the idea of morality, but it was often more around the idea, like there were some systems that were sort of like good evil systems. Like Shin Megami Tensei had like a order versus chaos system that they have used in some games and not in others. Mm-hmm. But then other Shin Megaten games were kind of just like, there are key moments in the game, and based on what you say in these moments, that decides your morality overall. And I think that was kind of like the approach that a lot of JRPGs took, was just like, there are key moments and that decides the ending you're going to get. Whereas Western RPGs were like, you're going to have this kind of summation of all of your deeds in the game over time. And that can include like little small things you do in like combat encounters, or like how you treat some random NPC or whatever. So, you know, kind of differing philosophies. But again, Shin Megaten kind of did its own thing with that. So did the Ogre Battle series. Ogre Battle had what is known as the Chaos Frame.
I like that.
Yeah, I don't know why they call it that. It's just a morality meter. Or it's a morality meter for like your revolution or your group. And it determines like who's going to join you and what endings you get and so on and so forth. Then, around the same time, immersive sims were also doing it. So immersive sims like Deus Ex and Vampire the Masquerade Bloodlines. Mm. Deus Ex's was just like, you know, there were just some big choices you could make, including the choice at the end, which was totally wild. You could either merge with a super powerful AI to become like basically all powerful, but like probably benevolent. Or you could like...
Probably benevolent.
I mean, probably. Who knows?
Who knows?
You know, you can write your own headcanon for that. Mm-hmm. But then either that, or you could like use it to guide the world from the shadows. Or you could just use it to blow up everything and send humanity back to the literal dark ages.
Wait a minute. Are we talking about Deus Ex or Mass Effect here?
Well, we're talking about Deus Ex, but, you know, maybe I don't think it's a stretch to think that the makers of Mass Effect played Deus Ex and, you know, maybe had some, those, got some ideas.
Those sounds a lot like the Control and like destroy endings.
I still don't know what those are because I still haven't finished Mass Effect 3.
Sorry.
Mm-mm. Yeah, I have no clue. But anyway, my favorite example of this, though, is Vampire the Masquerade Bloodlines, because, and I still think that, like, as far as morality systems go, it has one of the most interesting, because what it does that a lot of other games haven't is a lot of games, like, even when they're reframing things to not just be simple good versus evil, it's still fundamentally human morality. And so you always end up with a series of similar dilemmas, no matter what. Whereas Vampire the Masquerade said, well, you're a vampire. So you're existing according to vampire law, which is going to be very different from regular human law. Your priorities are different. Your main goal is to not have vampires be found out. But I mean, like, you know, according to the rules, it's okay.
The rules of the Camarilla.
If you kill a person, because that's what you do. You're a predator. You eat people. You don't want to do it in such a way where other people find out. That's bad. You should never do that. But I mean, killing people, whatever. That's part of your life.
Yeah, that's the whole Camarilla system in Vampire the Masquerade, which I used to LARP when I was in my late teens, early 20s.
Oh man, did you like pretend to bite people?
Oh, we pretended to bite people. We obfuscated by crossing our arms over our chests. And
wait,
I once
what?
Yeah, live action role
explain
play.
Explain that sentence. I know what those words mean.
Obfuscation is a power in Vampire where you cannot be seen suddenly. And in the live action role playing, you crossed your arms over your chest. So what you do is like the police would show up because, say, I'm Malkavian, the crazy vampire is called the police on the vampire gathering. And the police would show up and they'd put you against the wall and you go, oh my God, look at over there. There's a werewolf. The police would turn and then you'd cross your hands over your chest and they'd turn back around and go, where'd he go? Where'd he go?
And you'd be standing right there with your arms mm-hmm. over your chest.
Yes. It was beautiful.
That's wonderful. Mm-hmm. But yeah. So anyway. Yeah.
You've blown Ash's mind today.
Yeah. She'll have nothing to say for the rest of the podcast. She'll be like, but
I'm just thinking about all those, like all this stuff that I just don't know because I'm like, you know, a video game journalist baby and you could absolutely be pulling my leg and I would have no idea.
Well, this is all serious stuff.
Yeah. I mean, I fully believe that Fahey once LARPed being a vampire. That does not shock me at all.
Oh, many times, many times.
But anyway, so yeah, vampire was really cool. And then also like the meter that you had was a humanity meter. And the idea was not to like try to max it out and be like the best possible human because you're not a human, you're a vampire. No. And the idea was instead just that like if you did too many things that kind of caused it to go down, then you'd go feral. But that wasn't a game over. It just meant that sometimes you'd lose control and also get ridiculous stat boosts. So people would like build combat character builds around the idea that their character could go feral. And like that was a viable tactic. So it's just a neat game. So then we get to kind of the more modern BioWare renditions of things. So you had like KOTOR with its, you know, very Jedi influenced good versus evil stuff. But the other thing is that I think a lot of people kind of attribute the way that we view modern morality meters and karma systems to BioWare, and especially the like kind of simplistic good versus evil version of it. Mm-hmm. But I mean, aside from KOTOR, BioWare has spent basically all of their time trying to subvert that idea. Every game is a different subversion. Like Jade Empire did the whole open palm, closed fist thing. Mm-hmm. And the idea was less that it was like good versus evil and more that it was like, one was about harmony and acceptance and being part of your world and your community. And the other was about basically being like, well, no, you should be very self-sufficient. And the world needs to know that even if like I, as this, you know, closed fist character have to teach them that lesson. I'm doing this to better them. The problem with that is that ultimately the decisions you made were still pretty like good versus evilly. Mm-hmm. But it was a different philosophical outlook on it. Then like similarly, you know, Paragon versus Renegade. It's not good or evil. And in fact, you can be a Paragon who does Renegade actions or vice versa, depending on, you know, the situation that you're in. Although again, BioWare has this habit of coming up with new systems that do it differently and then shooting themselves in the foot.
Yeah. Yeah.
So like you still, Paragon and Renegade still incentivize you to be one or the other all the way through with like stat boost incentives. And then like in Mass Effect 2 and later like general ability stuff and like the choices you make contribute to something larger. So you should just make the same kind of choice over and over forever. But they tried. And I think their best effort was Dragon Age. Because they're like, you know, again, we're basing this on Baldur's Gate. So no meter. It's just about how your characters perceive you. And that
could, yes.
Yeah. And like, that also means that you get a lot of moral gray areas. Like I was looking at examples and like one person pointed out that at one point, you know, Alistair, character who's usually good, will approve of killing blood mages because he's a paladin, so he doesn't like them. Meanwhile, in that same situation, Morrigan, who's kind of like evil, will be like, no, well, that's awful. No. I mean,
she's not evil.
She's not evil, but she's
a blood mage.
Well, I mean, she's blood magey and she's prone to doing things that I think a lot of other characters would typically take issue with. She's the one who's usually okay with killing people. But in this situation, because she's also a practitioner of atypical magic, she's going to be like, I don't like what you're doing here if you decide to, you know, kill a blood mage. So, you know, you're dealing with a bunch of different characters, different motivations. And I think that's just the most interesting way to do things in general. It's also the hardest to do.
Yeah, and Dragon Age was a game where your companions could react to the things that you do. So, like, if you defile the Urn of Sacred Ashes in Dragon Age, Liliana will leave your party. That kind of stuff.
Right, which again is all very Baldur's Gate.
Which they haven't done again.
It's all very Baldur's Gate inspired, though. Like, I mean, and that was the goal. BioWare was always like, we are going to make a spiritual successor to Baldur's Gate. This is it. And they did a really good job with that part. I still feel like in terms of interesting choices, Dragon Age Origins probably is BioWare's best game. I mean,
I agree.
But yeah, so then like also, again, kind of in the early thousands period, early and mid thousands, you started getting like for a minute, good versus evil systems were super popular. They're just like in everything. And so you also got a lot of the more like ridiculous ones. I think the one that a lot of people point to is kind of being just like, what are we doing here? Was the original BioShock, because it was just so binary. I mean, one thing that a lot of people, I think, maybe forget is that if you harvested two little sisters, that was it. You were super duper evil no matter what. Could not come back from two. And I find that to be like the most counterproductive way to make that system, because I feel like the arc for that, for a plausible character in a setting like that, would be to show up and, like, you know, see all these crazy genetically modified people and hear all of this rhetoric about like, this is the way to live down here. And so harvest a couple of them and then, like, you know, realize that they're going to be able to survive, that they don't need to be terrified anymore, and be like, this thing I'm doing is messed up. I can't keep doing this. I have to, like, be better and, you know, save them. So it's like the game undermined its own most interesting arc with a morality system. And then, like, other games that also did just out of place weird morality systems, like Infamous. Do y'all remember that game?
Infamous is great. Come on.
I mean, it's a fun game.
Infamous and Prototype were two games that were, depending on if you did bad things or good things, you got a certain power set. And it kind of followed the whole Jedi Knight thing from the Old Republic.
Yeah, the Jedi Knight games were.
Yeah, but you could, you got different powers based on if you were good or evil. So there's a player type who's like, okay, these powers are the most effective, so I'll do whatever I can to get that. And it was less of a, it was less of a morality thing than it was, these skills are better, I want to be that guy.
Right, which is always an issue that games with these systems have, is that in trying to tie them more closely to what you are doing as the player, as opposed to just like a few story moments, they usually end up tying them directly to the powers you get or to stat boosts or whatever. And in doing so, change your motivation. Your motivation stops being, I'm going to make the choice that feels most authentic to me, and becomes, I'm going to make a choice to get a power. And so, like, I think that was a thing that designers spent a lot of, like, the 2000s learning, and are still learning to an extent. But anyway, let's see. So after BioShock, you get BioShock 2, which did a way better job, more nuanced, like, more possible endings. And then also, it was decided not just by, like, harvesting or killing little sisters, which was always a really silly idea, but also through, like, key moments with some really interesting and morally complicated NPCs. BioShock 2 is great. Super underrated. Everyone should play it. And oh yeah, the best bit was that the ending wasn't really about you. Throughout the whole game, you were like, you know, you learned that you had a daughter, basically. And so you became an example for her. And at the end of the game, she's the one who takes the final action based on what she learned from watching you throughout the whole game. And so, yeah, it's just like it's a cool twist. I liked it. Oh man, Fable was super funny. Did either of y'all play the original Fable?
I played the original.
All sorts of wonderful.
You mean a real estate simulator?
Uh-huh. Yeah, no, the game where you could be.
We can't walk over this bush?
Yeah, you could be an evil capitalist overlord and, like, take villagers out into the forest and kill them in order to free up housing that you could then, you know, sell to other people for more money. And that didn't really get you that many evil points. Similarly, you can marry somebody and kill them and only get like 60 evil points. Or you can marry someone and divorce them and get 600. Don't get divorced, folks. It's the worst sin you can commit.
As long as no one calls me Chicken Chaser, I'm fine.
Yeah. I'm going to call you that for the rest of the episode.
No, you're not.
No, I probably won't. But
I will hang up. I'll hang up right now.
And then, yeah, let's see. We also got, like, the much more, compared to KOTOR 1, KOTOR 2 had a way more complicated set of morality. Like, it still used the meter, but it was like, well, let's, like, try to deconstruct this whole thing. So it inserted the character of Kreia, who just questioned all of your decisions. The most notorious being that there's a bit where a beggar approaches you and asks you for some credits. And if you give the beggar credits, Kreia will be like, well, this means that this person's now, like, a target for being mugged. You may have brought unwanted trouble to them in the future. But if you don't give them money, then the beggar apparently gets upset and takes it out on another beggar. Like, it's this moment where, like, no matter what, you feel unsatisfied, or you're like, well, the moral ramifications of your actions can go much further than you think. I mean, in hindsight, I think that like, even though that's the primary example, it's kind of a cheap one. But that was kind of like the way the game approached being a like lighter dark side Jedi. It was like, well, sometimes you're, no matter what you do, bad things happen. Also a good game, albeit one that was kind of all over the place. But yeah, and that brings us to kind of, you know, the more modern day of, I think, fewer meters. Meters kind of like KOTOR 2 and games like that, even though KOTOR, you know, 2 preceded games like Mass Effect, and even I think Dragon Age. It was sort of this like turn where people started trying to subvert the meter instead of just including it. So there was that. And then I think the other big takeaway is that we had this brief moment in like the mid to late 2000s where a lot of people were using morality meters. But I think that they like became this popularly conceived of thing as like, you know, every game is just like, are you going to save all the babies or kill the babies? And it's like, actually only a few games did that. Most of them, even the ones that used morality meters, tried pretty hard to give you these like morally complicated situations. And like, maybe the meters didn't always help, or they incentivized weird decision-making. But like, generally, games try pretty hard in this area, even when they don't succeed. So yeah.
Well, I mean, yeah, I want to say one of the best examples of choices in that era was the Telltale games, The Walking Dead.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And such, where instead of having a meter at all, because this is a show about choice and not just meters. Instead of having a meter, you do something and it would say so and so will remember that.
Yeah.
And you get like this rush of anxiety, like, oh shit, crap, I mean, is that good or bad?
I was gonna talk about that in a later segment, but I think that like that is maybe one of the most brilliant sentences anyone has ever put in a video game. Because like in many cases, those choices didn't come back up. They were never like, so-and-so did not actually remember that. But it got you thinking. Mm-hmm. And more importantly, it specifically got you thinking not about like, what will I unlock for making this decision? But rather, how do other people perceive me? And like, just having little moments that put you in that frame of mind was super smart on Telltale's part. Like that was, I think the lesson that everyone should just learn from their games was that like, make the player think about how everyone else is thinking about them. Because that makes their choices totally different.
Before we get too far into the choices that we like and didn't like and thought were really cool, we're going to take a short break.
Angie's List is now Angie, and we've heard a lot of theories about why.
I thought it was an eco move. Fewer words, less paper.
No, it was so you could say it faster.
No, it's to be more iconic.
Must be a tech thing.
But those aren't quite right. It's because now you can compare upfront prices, book a service instantly, and even get your project handled from start to finish.
Sounds easy.
It is, and it makes us so much more than just a list. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I. Or download the app today.
And we're back on Kotaku Split Screen. Today, we're talking about choices. And for this next segment, we're going to talk about some of our favorite choices in video games. Fahey, I know you play a lot of games with a lot of choices. What's some of your favorites?
Now, are we talking about our favorite choices, or are we talking about like the toughest choices we've had to make? Or
either or.
Both. Yeah. What do you think?
Make a choice.
Nah.
Damn it. Knew I was going to go into that. My favorite choice in all of gaming came at the end of Nier Automata. Automata. Automata.
Nier.
I just played the game and I can't believe I forgot about that.
Did you play through Automata? Automata?
Yes.
You did play through it.
Nathan, did you? I don't think you did.
Are you forgetting a very key moment in the split screen canon?
We took it.
That's right.
Yeah, just rub my face in it, though.
That's okay. I've been getting the PS5 ads for friggin' Genshin Impact, a game I don't understand or know. And I'm like, I want to, damn it. But no, at the end of Nier, at the very, very end of Nier, so the spoilers, you're given a huge choice. And I believe it's the same choice you got at the end of, like, Drakengard 3. But was it the original Nier? I'm all confused.
I think it was the original Nier.
It was the original. You're right. I get my Yoko Taras mixed up, as we all do. But at the end of the original, the end of Nier Automata, the very end, the game's like, okay, so do you want to get the final ending, or do you want to delete your or do you want to delete your save game forever and not? What exactly was the choice?
I think it was like help you. Me. It was this. You were in this like shoot 'em up section, yes, where you had to like go through the credits, and it's really hard. And you're like, if you can accept help, and it'll make it a lot easier, but you will delete your save file, mm-hmm, I think, or something like that. Like you can accept help. You can accept help, I think, and then I think, and at the end, you can choose to like provide help to others, but to do so, you have to give delete up your save file.
Right. You become one of the people that comes in and helps. But in order to do so, you have to delete your save file.
Oh, man, that's
as
really
if you
cool.
never played before. And that, I sat there with that on my screen for the longest time. It was hours and hours where I just look at it and go, I don't know, I'm going to come back to that. I left it on my screen.
The cool thing about that choice is that there are no repercussions. Like, it's something, like, there are no, like, in-game repercussions for choosing not to help.
Right.
If you accepted help, it's just, like, it's something that you have to wrestle with internally.
Yeah,
like,
you feel bad. You would feel actively bad that all these people sacrificed themselves to help you, and then at the end, you're like, yeah, fuck you guys. Bye.
Yeah, like, you be easy. Yeah, you know, that's good. I'm good, you know, or you just don't. Yeah, I love that too. Like, and one of the cool things about that is there's a musical cue when you do that. Like, so like we were shooting, like you can hear the music and it's like one person singing, and then you accept help and you get all these people that like jump in and then it turns into a chorus.
Oh,
it's
my God.
Beautiful.
I got chills thinking of that moment. It's such a great moment.
It is.
That Nathan will never experience.
I'll never get to experience. I mean, it's kind of fun for me to experience it vicariously through the two of you, because you are so animated about it. And so it is pleasant to watch.
Are we automated about it?
Automatated.
It's
really hard.
Are you having a stroke, Ash? Are you okay?
We have a hard time pronouncing automata. And I tried to verb it, and that was a poor choice. Wow. On my
are
part.
You being automated? How about that? That would have been
there. I guess that would have worked.
Damn, oh, well, this podcast what in 10 do we years. Know? We're just gonna automate it. We're gonna have a lot of like AI run it.
We're just writers for a living.
Nathan, do you have a tough or favorite choice?
Yeah. I mean, I think that there are a lot of games that I think do interesting choices in like really fun ways. Like Undertale's the obvious one, but Undertale doesn't really have a hard choice. It just like kind of has a lot of choices you don't know you're making. And then it turns out that you've made them and they're like really crucial to how the game unfolds. So, I mean, I think in terms of hard choices, even this is a little bit like, for one, I think that the idea of romance in general counts as a choice. Who are you going to romance is always, and in games that do it well, it's really hard. I think the toughest one for me, and I blogged about this forever ago, but was in The Witcher 3, mainly because like I romanced Triss and then found out that if you try to romance both Triss and Yen, you get like an ending that is pretty true to the series, but like means you didn't actually romance anyone at all. And so I was like, oh, well, I actually don't really like Triss very much after all. And so I ended up being like, first I put the game down for months. I was like frustrated. And then I resumed it and I was like, well, I don't like that I made this decision. So I'm going to go back and unmake it. And the save closest to me being able to do that is 15 hours in the past. So I replayed 15 hours of The Witcher 3 just to do a different romance option.
Just a fuck.
Uh-huh. And I mean, not just a fuck, because in, you know, in The Witcher there, you can do that a lot. But I mean, for like the real one.
Yeah, this is once more with feeling.
Yeah, this is the one that counts. yeah, that was my Witcher-related tale of woe. I feel like everybody has at least one.
That game came a long way from the first The Witcher game, where you were collecting cards every time you slept with a woman.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, God.
Yeah, it was horrible.
The first Witcher was really, yeah. Yeah, I mean, it was a mix of implicitly and explicitly sexist.
Yeah, no, The Witcher, the original Witcher was peak Euro garbage. Everything's brown. Just as they were starting to get woke over there.
Oh, way to insult an entire continent, Faye.
They don't listen. This is a US only podcast, right?
But yeah, it's true. I mean, yeah, we're speaking a different vernacular of English, so they can't even understand it.
I will say it's just a genre of game they had back when everything was brown and everything was an RPG and there were skeletons.
There were skeletons.
Skeletons. That's how they say skeletons in Europe.
Yeah. Okay, so Ash, what is your hardest choice?
Nathan, you might have to like plug your ears.
Oh, no.
We're talking Mass Effect. We're talking end of Mass Effect.
Yeah, we're talking end of Mass Effect. And I, in the hopes that you are playing through the Legendary Edition, probably not.
About that.
I didn't think you were. I still kind of want to, I like the idea that you have been kept whole and pristine from like the absolute shit show that was that ending, talking to Mass Effect 3. And I want to preserve that innocence.
Okay, here's what we do. I'm going to take off my headphones. When you are done explaining this ending and discussing it, do some sort of fun hand gesture. Like,
okay.
Yeah. Like, I don't know, something that'll get my attention.
Okay.
Me do that. Wait, I'll just mute. I'll just turn off my sound.
Okay, that's fine.
Okay, go say, like, do it. I can't hear anything.
Okay. So the ending of Mass Effect 3.
He's probably lying. He's probably lying.
I mean, he's that still would be listening. Funny. That would be funny.
Could him pretend he's not.
Faye, have you played Mass Effect 3?
I have played Mass Effect 3.
Okay. So I'm talking about the endings, mm-hmm. right? Like, you go through all this pain and trouble to get this super MacGuffin to defeat the Reapers and save the galaxy, right? And it ends up being this, like, tiny child who has been, like, haunting you for the entire game mm-hmm. that's actually, like, the will of these, like, old super race of aliens or whatever that's left a giant gun in the Citadel. And they give you three choices. And your choices are to destroy the Reapers, which will apparently destroy all the Mass Effect relays, which is how people get around, mm-hmm. which will, like, you know, set technology back like billions of years. And it will also have the effect of killing all of the Geth, which, depending on your choices, are either your best friends or they're already all dead or something like that. Mm-hmm. And all AI, like all AI constructs. So like Edie will also die if you choose to destroy ending. Yeah. And then there's the control ending where you like become one with the Reapers and you can control them and you can like send them away for whatever. And then there's the synthesis ending. And the synthesis ending is where you merge like sentient, like biological life and like robot life. Uh-huh. And the toughest choice for that for me was like at first I was all like, oh, synthesis all the way. Yeah. Because synthesis, like you, depending on like what you do in the game, like you either get control or destroy. But if you do the most with the game and like whatever, you get the synthesis ending. So it's kind of like presented as, okay, this is the middle of the road option. This is the best way to go because it's kind of unlocked. And then you do all this work to unlock it. So it's kind of like setting itself up to be the best. But then you think about it for a little bit and I'm like, wow, you're really fundamentally altering trillions of people. Like you are just making this unilateral choice about their bodily autonomy mm-hmm. without their consent at all. And you think about like synthesis is presented as this good ending. And it's actually like, to me, the most horrific. And it took a long time for me to come around to that. And so then I eventually went with destroy and I just headcanon all the way the fact that it kills the Geth and Edie. So that was my toughest choice.
No.
And it's still really bad. Like it's not a great choice, but because I role play a lot when I play the BioWare games, it's like my Shepard would want to finish this fight. The Reapers are dicks. We have to get rid of them. And I'm just going to headcanon away that they kill all of my robot friends. Well, okay, we're going to bring Nathan in.
Here's the thing. Everybody wants to fuck a robot though.
Yeah.
And if you make if you make everybody robot / AI, everybody gets to fuck a robot.
No.
You're taking that from people. Thanks
also
a lot.
Taking away their bodily autonomy. Like, you're creating these, like, weird constructs. Like, what have you done to me?
Oh, here's the thing. You don't have to go to the bathroom or eat anymore, and you get to have sex with robots all the time. But you know what? I decided not to do that. Let's kill the Geth. You should wave your hands and bring Nathan back. Let's wave your hands.
I like how he perked up when he saw. I was like, oh, it's time for me to come back in now.
Yeah, there we go.
Welcome back, Nathan.
Wow.
I want you to guess as to what you think the conversation was. Based on your absolutely limited knowledge of anything that has to do with Mass Effect 3's ending.
Yeah, okay, okay. So you had trouble deciding which of several different musical numbers Morden can perform at the end of the game to celebrate your outright and utter victory over whatever the big threat is of the Reapers. Yeah.
I wish that was in the game.
Yeah.
Sadly, it's not in the game.
Oh.
Yeah.
That's a bummer.
Ashley thinks that no one deserves to have sex with robots. That's what it comes down to. Mm. Anyway.
That's rough.
Anyway. Well, now that we've discussed our toughest and most fun choices, do we have a worst choice? Just quick.
Oh, man. A worst choice in a game.
Like a choice you regret?
Oh, I definitely do.
Oh, no.
Oh, man. I'm going back to The Witcher 3 for this because I think that it is one of the best examples of like a horrible outcome for a choice. Basically, the worst possible outcome for the notorious Bloody Baron quest is like the grimmest, darkest shit possible. Because, I mean, the Bloody Baron quest is already really dark. Mm-hmm. There's around a baron who, like, initially you think that his wife and daughter left him because of like a monster, because it's The Witcher and monsters are the problem, are the cause of tons of problems. But the real cause of the problem was man. And so, like, basically it turns out the baron, struggling with a lot of things. He was a drunkard. He beat his wife and, you know, caused his daughter to leave. In beating his wife, caused her to miscarry, like really grim shit. And so depending on how you go about making a series of choices within this, you can end with a scenario where, as it turns out, his wife like left and was basically taken in by like these bog witches. And if you get her back in the wrong way, then the witches will like turn her into one of them. And you can like get the curse lifted, but doing that kills her. It turns out she's being kept alive by the curse.
Oh, no.
And so in response to this, and also the Baron's daughter's refusal to come back and his abject hatred or her abject hatred of him for everything he's done, you walk into like the little keep where he used to live and he's just hanging from a tree.
Jesus.
Yeah. And like, there's no cutscene for that part either. You just walk in and he's there and you're like, oh, fuck.
Oh goodness.
Oh, now that's cool.
Yeah.
I like when they do little things and they don't call your attention to it, like in a special cutscene.
Yeah.
Like you just have to notice it. That's neat.
That was another moment where I reloaded my save. I was like, this is too dark. And like the other way that the quest can turn out is still pretty dark, but it's not that dark.
Don't you like get to keep the baby? Like depending on how you do that, like the baby's just like walking around like, like this like grotesque thing.
It's a botchling.
A botchling.
Yeah.
Like it's just walking around like your little like Igor like thing, like
Yeah, I believe that's kind of creepy. Around. Yeah, you can choose to save or kill it.
That's what I call my kids when they're bad.
Wow, you call them little botchlings.
Oh, shame that you're being a little botchling. Yeah.
Aw, that's cute.
We want to do it.
Do you have a regret choice?
I regret the joke that I just made about my kids and calling them botchlings. That was a bad
idea.
They
don't listen to this podcast, do they?
I don't think so, but you never know. My children say the damnedest things.
Yeah.
I was, just real quick, and this has nothing to do with any choices other than choices I made as a parent. But I will say, this wasn't exactly the case, but we'll say I was watching a trailer for Ratchet & Clank, and the new Lombax came on, Rivet, and I was showing it to my son, Seamus, and he points to Rivet and goes, there's a lot of porn on that one.
And I was like, how did you get?
9. So I was like, what? And he goes, it's full 34, Dad.
Oh, boy.
What are you doing with your children? What are you not doing with your children?
See, I know for a fact he does not look at porn, but he is
aware.
Are
you sure?
Yes. He is aware of its existence and knows what rule 34 is. So
skeptical.
My
God bless you, Faye.
My choices were, my worst choice was becoming a parent. Anyway.
Yeah. Man, that's rough.
Ash, what's your worst choice?
My worst choice is really inconsequential and super quick. There's a moment, I think it's in Assassin's Creed 2 with Da Vinci, and you have the choice to hug him.
Oh.
And I didn't know what it was, and I wasn't paying attention, and I didn't hug him, and he's just kind of like standing there, like kind of leaving hanging, and I feel like an asshole.
Yeah, I know. Especially, okay, that scene is diabolical too, because when you don't do it, it quick cuts back to him, and you see the disappointment on his face. It's really fast.
But and I felt like a total asshole. Yeah, like, but I didn't feel like going back and reloading my save. Like, so I'm like, I'm sorry.
It like laser etches his sadness onto your eyes. So you're like, oh no, I'm so sorry,
I've disappointed Leonardo da Vinci.
That's okay. And the fun fact, in the future, if you go to the museum in the future, that picture of the schematic of man has a little frowny face on it. I'm kidding.
This is one of those things where I don't know if you're bullshitting me.
I was bullshitting you just then.
Yeah, okay, that's a lie.
Thank you. On that note, we'll be right back after a short break.
Achieving a gorgeous grin from home isn't a total mystery with BiteClear aligners. Just don't be surprised if all of your sleuthing friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. BiteClear aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
And we're back for our final segment, in which we're going to talk about, what is it, the evolution of changes? The evolution of changes, the change of evolutions,
you know, can really mean anything. I was thinking just like where we're at now. Like we've talked a lot about, you know, what choices have been. Where are they going? What are they up to?
Why won't they stop all the downloading?
What are they up to?
Wow.
What are changes like nowadays?
Yeah, I mean, what?
Choice.
Yeah, choices. What are choices like nowadays? No, I mean, it's an interesting question because I think like, to sort of ask a similar question to the one that I kind of opened with, what was the last game that y'all played that had like a meter in it? I mean, aside from Mass Effect, which is, you know, a remake of a game from, or a remaster of a game from like a decade ago. But I mean, before that, like what was the last game that you played where it was like, we're going to actively measure your choices in this very like, you know, straightforward way that we've laid out on screen?
Fun fact, to bring it full circle, it was Oddworld Soulstorm.
Oh.
Which I guess isn't really, I guess yeah, it is like kind of like a choice.
Right, but also.
But not like, yeah.
It's a remake.
It's another remake. I mean, what's the most modern game you've played that's done that? Like,
probably something recent? Telltale. And by meter, I mean, it wasn't even a meter. So that doesn't even count. It doesn't count. Because, I mean, they bring up those, I was thinking of, you know, when they show you what choices everyone else made, and but that's not a meter. That doesn't count. So, yeah, I guess it would have been probably one of those superhero games I was talking about, Prototype or Infamous.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, I think we can safely declare ourselves, like, maybe fully out of the age of the meter. Like, I mean, even if we're talking about games that are sequels to, like, old games that included, you know, some sort of like a morality system, like Baldur's Gate 3 is now in development. But I mean, again, fully rooted in like a reputation system with the other characters and things that occur kind of just based on, you know, previous choices you made. There's no overarching idea of morality beyond what you think is right moment to moment and what that sort of broadly says about your character over time. And then like similarly, you know, I think it's interesting, Faye, that you mentioned Telltale. Because like Telltale felt like it was going to be, in terms of like choice in games, it was like revolution in the way that games were made, because those games were like relatively easy to make, budgetarily speaking, and like they're pumping out tons of them. Telltale was everywhere for a while. There's like a new Telltale game based on some new property, you know, like every few months.
Yep.
And then Telltale collapsed. And like that style of game just kind of went away. Like no one really picked up that torch. I mean, there are other kind of small scale adventure style games with like some choices, stuff like Oxenfree. But like Telltale evaporated and nothing took its place. Yeah, and so that's really interesting.
It's gone. It's, yeah, the whole genre? I mean, there's isn't someone remaking Sam and Max or something right now, or is that?
Mm-hmm. But I mean, yeah, that like style of choice just kind of, and I mean, it's I think gone. People got a little sick of it because like it was a thing where, you know, so much of Telltale Games was smoke and mirrors. It was like very evocative smoke and mirrors, but it was still like, mm-hmm. you know, we're going to make you feel like you have made an impactful choice, even if the game's not actually going to diverge that much. I mean, I guess you have like, you know, some bigger version, bigger budget versions of that kind of same idea. Like there's Until Dawn.
The Man of Medan and all the those games.
Yeah. Those are kind of like, I guess, filling a kind of similar niche, albeit without like all the licensed properties. And then there's like, you know, Quantic Dream is still existent.
Ew.
Yep. God. Yeah, for better or like worse.
Collective sigh.
We just all collapsed. That was amazing. Oh, poor Quantic Dream. They tried, but yeah, they...
Yeah, I mean, they've also been accused of some pretty heinous shit, so... But yeah, then you have like... I don't know, I think that games are also integrating choices in more interesting ways. Like, I mean, this is going to be my, what, second week in a row talking about it, but Pyre is a game that did a really good job of being like... Instead of having choices be based even on like your character's personal morality, even like your own internal sense of morality, this is just more about like, how do you like these characters? Who do you care about? Who makes the most sense for you in terms of gameplay, but also in terms of like when they should like go back to this other world that will then render them inaccessible to you? And like, how good are you at making these like very bittersweet choices that are never like, who should you kill or who should you save or whatever? They're just like, everyone that's in your party is trying to escape from this kind of hell-like place back to the world they came from. And in what order are you going to do that? And what impact will that have on the story? And it's just this very like, it centers the gameplay around the choices rather than vice versa, which I think is really cool.
I think I would like a game that does not tell me it's monitoring the choices right. I make. So there's no meters. What?
I was about to say the exact same thing.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah. And just no indication whatsoever. And then, like, something happens, like, midway through the game, and you die. And then, like, your choices are evaluated. And you get sent to, like, heaven or hell, depending on what your choices are. And if you don't like that outcome, you can, like, go back and replay the game. But it's a little bit different. And you try to make the same or different choices again just to see, like, you want to change like your fate or something like that, but you have no idea what choices led to, you know, you being deemed doomed to hell or something like that. I think that would be fun.
You want a roguelike with some sort of decision-making system in there. I mean, I think the best decision-making system nowadays would be something where it's completely seamless. Mm-hmm. I mean, telegraphing, it was really dramatic. Lots of really dramatic moments in gaming have been built around choices like that. But I think I'd be better if it was just like you didn't know what was happening and you didn't
just
know.
Just like everyday little shit.
Well, I mean, that was the thing. That was Undertale before it became like hugely popular and a meme. Like, I think that there was some base level understanding that, you know, your decision to kill or not kill monsters would have an impact. But people, when they first played that game, did not know that was the morality system. The game was like logging all of your decisions in that regard. And, you know, spinning up this fairly like complicated tapestry of things based on that. So, I mean, there's that. I think a handful of other games have also tried to have like pretty invisible morality systems. A personal favorite of mine that's almost a decade old now, literally a decade old, is this like side-scrolling survival horror game called Lone Survivor.
I think I remember you talking about this before.
Yeah. That game had an invisible morality system that was based on just like some of the random actions you took, some of the decisions you made. I mean, again, like it didn't really telegraph it at all. There are some moments where like the screen would flash a certain color if you did certain things, but the whole game was supposed to be evocative of like kind of a dreamlike state. And so it was very good at like just kind of getting you to, you know, do what you thought made sense in the moment. And then there were a series of endings kind of based on that. But it was interesting because like, a lot of it was rooted in how you were like taking care of your own character and like, you know, making sure that he was like getting fed and like, you know, making his way into a better state of mental health. But then the game still tested that. Like at the very end is a pretty difficult boss fight and you can either like, you may not have enough ammo for it, but there's this one guy who, like, you can trade him pills that are bad for him for ammo. So you can, like, have done all this great work and taken care of yourself and then totally undermine that by giving pills to a guy because you need more ammo. And it's just
being,
like,
a drug dealer.
Yeah. So that game was really interesting in that regard. But yeah, I mean, I think generally we've kind of, like, crested this. We've hit this point where games are being a little bit more thoughtful.
Talking with your hands on a podcast.
Yeah, I know. I can't help it. Especially because, like, now I've gotten to go back out into the real world a little bit more. So I'm back to talking with my hands more. Whereas before I was just like, who cares? No one can see my hands anyway during the pandemic. But yeah, I mean, I think that there are a handful of games that are doing the invisible choice thing, but it's also, like, really hard to do in a satisfying way.
Yeah.
Disco Elysium.
Oh, yeah. Oh, man. How have we not?
I haven't played that one.
Disco Elysium.
Oh, really? Ash, play Disco Elysium. Seriously. We need to have a whole episode on Disco Elysium.
Is that the old Fallout people?
No. No, they are. Oh. So the people who
made... That's the other game that sounds like that? Outer Wilds or whatever?
Outer Worlds is old Fallout.
You might be
people,
thinking of Wastelands.
Oh, Jesus Christ.
Oh, yeah. You are thinking of Wasteland. Yeah, Wasteland's all right. Disco Elysium's amazing. And based on, like, some of your other tastes in games, like, you'd love it. Ash, you should play it.
Fine.
But yeah, if you want to talk about, like, interesting choices and, like, a lot of them being invisible in terms of, like, your morality, but still, like, adding up to something. I mean, yeah, you're right, Fahey. Like, Disco Elysium wins. The end.
That's beautiful. All right. Finish the podcast.
So, at the end of the podcast, I guess I have homework too.
You do.
Play Disco Elysium. I will come back in a week and we'll discuss. So, yeah, there it is.
Nice.
So cool. This has been another Split Screen podcast. Thanks for listening.
We know you have many podcasts to choose from. Thank you for choosing to listen to us.
There you go. Good job, Fahey. Mm-hmm. You are listening to Kotaku's You were listening. You have made the choice to listen to Kotaku's Split Screen podcast. You can choose to reach us via email at splitscreen@kotaku.com or choose to contact us on Twitter at Uncle Fahey, that's Mike Fahey, or at Vaughn, V-A-H-N-16, that's Nathan, or at Ad Astra, A-D-A-S-H-T-R-A, that's me. Our producer chooses to be Michaela Heck. I think actually she doesn't have a choice on that. And our sound engineer is Jamie Colazzo. Have a great week, everybody.
You had no choice to be Michaela Heck.
It was just an interesting kind of existential question, I think.